safer place. She spends the next hour floating between the teams, having fun watching the kids solve problems and teaching them little tricks here and there to make them more productive and joyful. When the kids adjourn, packing up their huge, heavy backpacks, Maxine realizes that she's in a very good mood. The joy of teaching people something that they want to learn is awesome. Plus, these are really great kids. She thinks about how easy everything is here. You hit Control-Enter, and the program builds and runs. If there is an error, you fix it, hit a key, and try again. In her current work hellhole, it's the opposite. She still can't build any part of the Phoenix system. Somehow builds have ceased being a part of everyone's daily work. Maya and Paige made the same indentation mistake for a half hour. At Parts Unlimited, there are 100 developers probably making bigger mistakes, and it'll be months before they realize they've done something wrong. Everyone waves goodbye to Maxine, thanking her for all her help. She climbs into her car and slumps in her seat. To her surprise, she feels sad and dispirited. At work, there is none of the joy and learning that she just experienced here. She wonders if this is how everyone on the Phoenix Project feels all the time. Maxine is about to start her car when her phone vibrates. It's a text message from one of her collaborators on an open source project she wrote to help her with personal task management. She started this project over 5 years ago to help her keep awesome work diaries. She's always been a manic record keeper of how she spends her time. Initially, it was just to help her be more productive, to triage her incoming tasks from email, Trello, Slack, Twitter, reading lists, and what seemed like a gazillion other places where work is generated. Her app lets her easily push work into GitHub, Jira, Trello, and many other tools where she interacts with other people and teams. Over the years, she's used this program every day to help her run most of her professional and personal life. It's where she sends all her tasks. It's her master inbox, where she can see all her work and move work between all the systems that she works with. Many other people use her application too, and some have written adapters to other tools they need to connect to. She's constantly amazed that thousands of people around the world use it every day, with over 20 active contributors writing code for it. She looks at the new pull request from the text message. Someone has created a new adapter to the task manager. The proposed change looks fantastic. She's wanted to do it for years. Their change is quite clever, and she approves of the way the automated tests were written to show that his change works without breaking anything else. He also documented his work, writing several paragraphs on what he did and why. She approves of the way he's turned it into a tutorial so others can do something similar. She loves seeing other people's ingenuity and their willingness to make the app better. As the project owner, she sees it as her primary responsibility to ensure that any contributor can be productive. A couple years ago, there were over 20 active pull requests, but for a variety of reasons, she couldn't merge them in. Sometimes the changes were conflicting. Sometimes her API couldn't quite accommodate what they needed. She knows it's dispiriting when you submit a change to someone's project, but no one ever looks at it, or they tell you that it can't be integrated. If that happens enough, people eventually give up or fork your project and splinter the community. So when this started happening to her project, she spent every evening for weeks re-architecting her system so that people could quickly, easily, and safely make the changes they wanted. It took a lot of effort, and she personally rewrote every pull request so that the contributors didn't have to redo their work. But everyone was delighted and grateful when their changes made it in. But not as delighted as Maxine. Maxine knows that agility is never free. Over time, without this type of investment, software becomes more and more difficult to change. There are exceptions, like floating point math libraries that haven't changed in 40 years. They don't need to change because math doesn't change. But in almost every other domain, especially when you have customers, change is a fact of life. A healthy software system is one that you can change at the speed you need, where people can contribute easily without jumping through hoops. This is how you make a project that's fun and worth contributing to, and where you often find the most vibrant communities. She drives home and is delighted that her husband has already taken care of dinner. She regales her kids about her last-minute decision to visit their old middle school and the exciting new generation of geeks. When they disappear to do their homework, she grabs her laptop and brings up the exciting new pull request. She pulls the code in and spins up the new version on her laptop. She logs in and clicks around, testing some of the corner cases to make sure he got the details right. Smiling, she brings up the pull request in her browser and clicks a button which merges it into the code base. She writes a thank you note to the submitter, complimenting him on his cleverness and initiative. Before hitting send, she notices something he wrote. "Maxine, I'd throw you a huge party if you could display a desktop notification whenever someone modifies this property." Good idea, she thinks. She pulls up her code editor and in the next 15 minutes takes a stab at implementing this idea. When it works the first time, she grins and laughs out loud, clapping her hands in gleeful self-congratulation. She's in a great mood. You can do so much with so little effort because of all these miracles of technology. She resumes her note to the submitter. "Again, really nice work. I'm sure everyone is going to love it as much as I do. Thank you. And I just added your notification feature. Your offer for throwing me a party is accepted." Hitting send, she wonders if the universe is sending her a message. Her afternoon with the middle schoolers and the ease with which she added functionality to her application, which is years older than the Phoenix Project, shows her what coding should feel like. She is able to build things with focus, flow, and joy. She had fast feedback in her work. People were able to do what they wanted without being dependent on scores of other people. This is what great architecture enables. She has been exiled to the most strategic initiative of the company, on which the survival of the entire company hinges, and yet, hundreds of engineers are paralyzed, unable to do what needs to be done. In that moment, Maxine decides she must bring this level of productivity that she's helped create for middle schoolers and her open source project to the Phoenix Project, even if it means personal suffering in the short term. Chapter 4, Thursday, September 11th. The next morning, Maxine still feels triumphant from yesterday's numerous victories. But as Kurt predicted, everyone is freaking out. To everyone's shock and disbelief, the launch was not going to be called off or delayed. Instead, the Phoenix Project is going to be launched tomorrow at 5. Captain Kirk apparently hit the warp speed button, despite Engineer Scotty telling him the dilithium crystals were about to blow. So, no boring status meetings today. Instead, every meeting is in a genuine shitstorm, with people on the verge of panic. One meeting quickly devolved into bedlam and pandemonium, full of questions, objections, and shocked disbelief. People were furiously typing away on their phones and laptops, and a third of people in the room were making phone calls. It was like watching an old movie from the 40s with reporters racing out of the courtroom to the payphones or back to their offices, frantic to break the news first. Maxine turns to the person next to her, loudly yelling, "Has Phoenix ever been deployed into production before?" "Nope," he yells back. "Is there a release team yet?" Maxine asks. "Nope. Chris, Kirsten, and Bill are mustering up a formal release team today, but I have no idea who's going to be in charge," he responds, and mimics biting his fingernails in nervousness and fear. Maxine looks back at him, speechless. Maxine does not delight in the suffering of others, but watching the fireworks surrounding Phoenix is much more exciting than waiting for people to work on her tickets. She groans, realizing that given this crisis, no one will be able to work on her tickets now. Later that morning, Chris announces that William, the QA director, is in charge of the release team. His goal? Get everything into a releasable state and to coordinate with ops, who were blindsided too. Poor bastard. She knows that they are in big trouble. The Phoenix developers can't even merge their own code together without accidentally leaving parts of it behind or blowing up the build. Pulling off a successful production deployment seems wildly optimistic. Or plain batshit crazy, she thinks. "William, when is your release team meeting?" Maxine asks him as he jogs by. She runs to keep up. "Can I help?" "First meeting is in 1 hour. We need all the help we can get," he says, not even breaking stride. Maxine is delighted. Finally, a chance to actually use her skills and experience. This will be an interesting meeting, she thinks. Maxine has seen how Dev and Ops interact around Phoenix. Instead of acting like an actual team, they act more like sovereign states on the brink of war, with diplomats trying to patch together an uneasy peace, complete with embassies, protocols, and official formalities. Even scheduling a meeting between these two groups requires a summit and lawyers present. Regardless, she's excited to be in the game. In a perverse way, this is the most fun she's had on the Phoenix Project so far. She realizes she's grinning from ear to ear. Does this make me a bad person? She wonders. She grins again, not caring. Despite trying to arrive early, Maxine is late to the war room. They had to move the meeting twice because the crowd kept outgrowing the space. It's 15 degrees hotter in the room than in the hallway, and the air is stale. Nearly 50 people are crammed into a space designed for half that number. She sees Chris, Kirsten, William, and a bunch of the lead developers and managers. Kurt, sitting next to William, waves to her. On the other side of the table is Bill Palmer, surrounded by a phalanx of faces she doesn't recognize. She notices that there's something different about them. The largest one of them, to the left of Bill, has his arms crossed and a huge, unhappy scowl on his face. He shakes his head in disbelief. What is wrong with you people? You're telling me you don't know how many Windows servers you need? On top of the handful of Linux servers? Tell me again, how many exactly is a handful of servers? Is that in metric or imperial handfuls? While we're at it, you have any kumquat boxes you need, or perhaps a tandem? Flanking him are a woman and a younger man. The way they snicker makes Maxine immediately think of Crab and Goyle, the two mean-spirited goons who were best friends with Malfoy, Harry Potter's rival from Slytherin House. Says one of the dev managers. Actually, there is one component that could only run on Kumquat servers. It's an extension we had to build off of the existing message bus. But it's only a small modification. It shouldn't cause any problems, and it should add negligible load. Maxine hears groans from around the room, and not just from the Slytherins on the opposing side of the table. The younger man sitting next to the large man, whom Maxine is already thinking of as Big Malfoy, sighs. Technically, there's nothing wrong with kumquats. We have over a decade of experience running production workloads on them, and we understand their characteristics pretty well. The problem is that the reboot time for that cluster is almost 8 hours. We just need to be careful about anything that could involve restarts, like security patching. I'm concerned that certain changes will require multiple reboots, which could mean a day of downtime, or that they'll never come back at all. These are all the ops people, Maxine realizes. No wonder she hasn't seen them around. Wes, trust me. We are as afraid of that scenario as you are, the dev manager replies from across the table. We've been trying for 3 years to get this application replatformed, but it always takes a backseat to something more important. Yeah, you developers always make sure features take priority, and you never clean up all the technical debt you create. Typical crap, Big Malfoy says, gesturing angrily. Bill says to Big Malfoy, without even turning his head, "Stow it, Wes. Work the problem, stay focused." Yeah, got it, boss. Wes, Big Malfoy, says, "Handful of Linux servers, handful of Windows servers, and one kumquat server. Got it. Now, who can define a handful?" Maxine watches all the dev managers put their heads together, tabulating the compute needs for each of their components. It's clear they're just going on gut, not any sort of thoughtful capacity planning exercise. Maxine realizes that this release is in even more trouble than she thought. The developers still haven't merged all their code together, and they haven't defined the production environment that the application needs to run in. Describing your environment in handfuls definitely does not cut it. Raising her voice, she asks, "How many transactions per second are we expecting for product displays and orders? And how many transactions per second are the current builds capable of handling right now? That will tell us how many servers we need for the horizontally scalable portions, as well as how far we're off for the vertically scaled components like the database." The room falls silent. Everyone turns toward Maxine. They seem startled by her common sense question. The woman sitting to the left of Wes says,
"Thank you."
That is precisely what we need to know. Maxine gives a small nod and winks. Chris stands up. This is the highest publicity release in the entire company's history. Marketing has pulled out all the stops. They're going to spend almost $1 million getting the word out about the Phoenix launch. All the store managers have been given instructions to tell every customer to download the app and hit the website Saturday. They're even having contests to see which stores register the most new mobile customers. They're hitting all the industry and business press. They're trying to get either Sarah or Steve on all the news shows, even Good Morning America. Here are the best calculations that I've been able to get from marketing, Chris continues, flipping through his notebook. Expect 1 million people to come banging on the Parts Unlimited website and mobile apps. If all goes well, we should be prepared to sustain at least 200 orders per second. Maxine hears mutters and curses from all around the room. Wes scans the room and finally turns to Chris, all sense of jocularity gone.
Okay, that's good to know.
He gestures at Maxine. Our smart architect just asked how many transactions Phoenix can handle right now. Well? Chris looks to William, who pulls out a printout. Hot off the press from this morning. In our tests, Phoenix currently handles about 5 transactions per second. Anything over that causes the database clients to start crashing due to timeouts, including the mobile apps. I think we're missing a bunch of database indexes, but we haven't figured out which ones yet. William looks up. It's very, very not good, Chris. Wes sits in stunned silence for a moment, and then in a blunt, world-weary voice, he says to Chris, "We're not going to make it, are we?" No one says anything. Eventually, Bill asks, "Wes, what help do you need?" "I don't even know," he replies. "Maybe just give the team some air cover so they can stay focused." At that moment, Maxine hears a loud voice from the doorway. "For the survival of Parts Unlimited, we have to make this work. So, of course, we're going to make it." Oh, no, Maxine thinks. It's Sarah Moulton. She's dressed in a bright, expensive-looking yellow suit, and her face is so radiant that Maxine wonders how it's even possible. The fluorescent lights in the office usually make people look ghoulish and devoid of color. Maxine wonders if maybe she adds radium to her makeup to make herself glow like a 1950s bedside clock. Sarah has a certain dangerous glamour about her, and everyone in the room seems similarly wrapped. "We are in a market that is shrinking, with fierce competitors taking market share away from us," Sarah says. "Not to mention tech giants like Amazon and 20 new startups that are coming in to disrupt this entire category. As Steve said at the town hall, we've had 3 years to prepare for this. Now it's time for us to go to war and defend what is rightfully ours." She looks around the room, scanning for signs of resistance or rebellion. "This is the strategy the executives of this company have decided on. Anyone have a problem with that?" she challenges. Incredibly, Maxine hears herself laughing. Horrified, she covers her mouth. "Keep it together, Maxine." Quickly, she wipes all expression from her face, like a student caught doing something bad in high school. "Since when have you cared what people in authority think about you?" she wonders. "Ever since Chris warned me to keep my head down," she realizes. Maxine forces herself to look calmly at Sarah, with her best Lieutenant Savik expression, radiating only cool, dispassionate logic. "Something seemed particularly funny to you. Sorry, what is your name?" Sarah asks, looking at Maxine coolly. "Maxine," she replies, calmly. "I was laughing because you were talking about why you think Phoenix is important. But in this room, we're just trying to figure out how to get Phoenix deployed." "Which is not going terribly well either," Wes mutters loudly to some nervous laughter. "I can see that some of you have not bought into our mission," Sarah says, appraising everyone in the room. "Well, as I mentioned in the town hall, the skills that got us here are not necessarily the same skills that will take us to where we need to go. As leaders, we need to figure out if we have the right people on the bus. I'll be sure to keep Steve apprised. I know this release is personally very important to him." Upon hearing Steve's name, Chris looks at Maxine with disbelief and then covers his face with both hands. Nice job keeping a low profile, Maxine tells herself.
Okay, Sarah, that's enough, Bill says, standing up. Let's go apprise Steve about some of these problems and let the team figure out how to execute the release. We're only getting in the way here.
Yes, Steve needs to hear about this, she says. Sarah turns to leave, but then looks back at Maxine.
I like that you say what you think. If you're available sometime this week, let's get lunch. I'd like to get to know you better.
What the?
Maxine freezes like a deer in headlights. As women, we really need to stick together, don't we? Sarah says with a wink. With a frozen smile, Maxine says, thank you, I'd love to. Immediately she hates herself, embarrassed that so many people just witnessed her lying so badly.
Let's make it so, Sarah replies with a warm smile. And if you need someone to mentor you, I'd be happy to.
She looks at her phone and says, that's Steve. He needs something from me. I'll leave you to it. Remember, we all need optimism.
When Sarah is gone, Maxine lets out a long breath, not quite believing what happened.
She knows how important it is to have a great network, able to find people who can help get important things done, but she's not terribly excited to be associated with Sarah, no matter how influential she is. Maxine is very picky about who she associates with. For the next hour, Maxine drifts between the various groups as the huge release team tries to fully understand what is required to support the Phoenix launch. There are at least 12 different technology stacks that need to be deployed, more than Maxine had estimated during her build archaeology. She knew of the various application servers on Windows and Linux, and the front-end applications that run on the web, but she totally forgot about the two mobile applications, one for the iPhone and one for Android, and those all collectively hit at least 10 different back-end systems from across the business, all of which required changes in order to accommodate Phoenix. She had also forgotten that when you throw the operations teams into the mix, the number of teams involved more than doubles, because getting all those applications running in production requires the server administration teams, virtualization teams, cloud teams, storage teams, networking teams. All this reminds Maxine of why production deployments are some of the most complex activities of any technology organization, because they require so much coordination between so many different parts of the organization. And Phoenix wasn't just any deployment. It was designed to change how almost every part of the organization interacts with the customer. The more Maxine hears, the worse she feels. It seems impossible that they can get everything right the first time with this many moving parts. Getting an environment required Maxine to open up scores of tickets, and she still wasn't successful. She's guessing that deploying Phoenix will require hundreds, or maybe even thousands, of tickets. The project manager in the group she's sitting with says, won't we need a bunch of firewall changes too? Not just to external traffic. I don't think some of these systems have ever talked to each other.
Maxine raises an eyebrow. She hears more groans around the group.
Oh, great. The firewall teams usually need at least 4 weeks to get change requests through, says the woman who Maxine learns is Patty.
You think our change management process can be slow? We're speed demons compared to information security.
Suddenly, Maxine hears a door slam open behind her, and Patty looks up.
Well, speak of the devil. Here's John, our chief information security officer.
This should be fun, she says.
John is in his late 30s. He's about 20 pounds overweight, but his clothes are still baggy on him. Like in an old Western, John is flanked by two people, one male and one female engineer, who looks vaguely familiar.
At last, I've found you all, John sneers, looking around as if he were a sheriff who had hunted down a group of outlaws. I'm here about this mad plan to deploy the Phoenix application. This deployment will only happen over my dead body.
The woman behind John suddenly looks embarrassed, as if she's seen John say this before. John continues,
The Phoenix Project has millions of lines of new code, and we cannot responsibly deploy it without my team testing it for vulnerabilities. We just came out of a very, very interesting meeting with the auditors, and trust me, they aren't going to take it very kindly if we put something into production that jeopardizes our compliance posture. I have it on pretty good authority that the CIO and VP of IT operations were just fired over some compliance audit findings that were no longer tolerable, John continues. Let that be a warning to you that compliance is not just a moral obligation or a set of contractual obligations. It's also the law. Maxine wonders how many times John's rehearsed that line. That's a pretty good line, she acknowledges. Kirsten says from the front of the room, As you know, the decision to ship Phoenix came straight from the top. Steve Masters, the CEO, and Sarah Moulton, the SVP of retail operations. In fact, Sarah was just here, reminding us of that. The release is scheduled to start at 5 tomorrow, so that everything is live when stores open on Saturday morning. That's what you think, Kirsten, John says. I'm going to go speak with Steve right now. Rest assured that I will stop this madness. He turns to Wes. You were there at the meeting with the auditors. Tell them how serious this is and why there is no way the production release can happen tomorrow. Wes quickly replies, No, leave me out of this, John. That train has left the station and you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. The only thing we can do is figure out how to keep this rocket from blowing up on the launch pad and killing us all. Pardon the mixed metaphor, he says with a loud laugh, looking around the room to see who's with him. Or was that a simile? Wes asks suddenly, with a puzzled look on his face. The woman behind John says in a deadpan voice, It's a metaphor, Wes. When you say something is a pile of crap, that's a metaphor. When you say something is like a pile of crap, that is a simile. Thanks, Shannon, he says with a big smile. I've always gotten those confused. John glares at Shannon and then says angrily to Wes, I will not leave you out of this, Wes. It is your moral responsibility to stop this release. He turns to the whole room. It is all of your moral responsibility to stop this release. You all know where I stand. As I said, this release will be deployed over my dead body. Wes mumbles. We can always hope. Maxine hears some nervous giggles as John and his posse leave. Kirsten stands up, looking a bit uncomfortable. Well, I should take a moment to say that we made a commitment to deploy Phoenix on Friday. But if any of you feel you have a, moral obligation to not participate in this release, please let me know. Wes chortles. Kirsten, going down this path is almost certainly the stupidest thing I've seen in my entire career. But to support the team, I promise we'll all do what we can. With an air of weary exhaustion and resignation, he continues. Let's just get it over with. Maxine looks around, thinking about the sudden surreal appearance of Sarah and then John. She's reminded of Red Shirts by John Scalzi and Will Wheaton, a funny book loosely based on a Star Trek-like universe. It's written from the perspective of one of the Red Shirts, the nameless, low-ranking characters wandering in the background of the show, who learns that interacting with any of the bridge officers is bad news. Whoever is chosen to beam down to the planet with the officers is doomed to die in bizarre ways. An Alteron bloodworm, mind virus, carnivorous plants, an errant Klingon disruptor blast. In the book, the Red Shirts plant sensors everywhere to detect when the equivalents of Captain Kirk or Commander Spock come below deck so that they can hide. She is disheartened by how Parts Unlimited executives, the bridge officers, are so disconnected from the daily work of the Red Shirts in the technology organization. It was not helpful for Sarah to remind everyone of how saving the universe depends on Phoenix, and it was not helpful for John to appeal to their moral sense of correctness. We all know the threat the company faces is real, she thinks. The job of the bridge crew is to ensure the company's strategy is viable, not to remind them of the strategy or to micromanage everyone to death. Their job should be to ensure everyone can get their work done. How did this all come to be? Maxine drags herself back to her desk with a sandwich, exhausted from the endless Phoenix release meetings, surrounded by everyone who has similarly been sucked into the launch vortex. Oddly, she also sees some people happily working at their desks, as if it were just a regular day. Curious, she asks one of them why he doesn't seem very worried. He replies with a puzzled look. "I'm a developer. I work on features. I give them to QA and ops to test and deploy. Then I work on the features for the next release. That keeps me plenty busy." Maxine leaves, boggling at what he said. She has never in her career abdicated all testing and deployment to someone else. How can you create anything of value if you don't have feedback on how it's used? She thinks. When she gets to her desk, Kurt is there with a black 3-ring binder. Seeing her, he flashes a big smile. "I have a present for you." It's an 80-page document full of tabs. Just scanning the section headings makes her heart leap. They're the painstakingly assembled Phoenix build instructions, complete with links to documents, license keys, step-by-step tutorials, and even links to a bunch of videos. One is titled, "Getting Your Uber Jar to Run in Our Very Crazy Screwed-Up Production Web Cluster, 8 Minutes," and another is, "How to Monitor Your Apps Despite Our Ops Groups, 12 Minutes. She sees 20-character hexadecimal strings of activation codes and license keys. She sees usernames and temporary passwords for network shares. Best of all, there's a link to a 4-node virtual machine cluster with administrative access. That means Maxine will be able to do whatever she wants without having to fill out another service desk ticket. She's speechless. She feels her eyes tearing up. Over license keys? She wonders for a moment whether she has lost all sense of perspective. But after being stuck inside the Phoenix Project, having someone actually care about what she needs is so unexpected and so utterly appreciated. Maxine is reminded of when she and her family volunteered for a day to help new refugee families. She remembers how her then 10 and 8-year-old kids reacted when families cried, when they were given food, soap, and laundry detergent. There is nothing so rewarding as providing something to someone who really needs your help. She needed help, and she received it. Elated, Maxine flips through the document. She sees a long list of Windows registry keys that need to be set. "Don't worry, Maxine," Kurt says, politely ignoring her emotional reaction. "You have the electronic version of this in your inbox, so you can copy and paste everything." With a twinkle in his eye, he adds, "And there's a link to a wiki page where you can incorporate any notes if we missed something. There's a bunch of people who really appreciate your work. We've been trying to crack the Phoenix build puzzle for months, but we've never been able to work on this full time. Your notes helped us put all the pieces together. This saved us months of work." Maxine's brow furrows. She has no idea what Kurt is talking about, but she doesn't even care. "Thank you so much. I can't tell you how much this means to me. How can I ever repay you for this?" "Anything to help another hardworking engineer trying to help other engineers be productive," Kurt says, laughing. But with a serious look on his face, he adds, "If you want to meet the people who made all this happen, despite considerable adversity and huge obstacles that typically prevent feats of greatness like this, come to the Dockside Bar tonight at 5. We meet there on Thursdays." "Wait, hang on a second," Maxine says, suddenly suspicious. "If this all works, how come everyone isn't using it?" "That is a great question with some very surprising answers," Kurt says. "The short version is, the official build team hasn't exactly authorized these. They seem to view our efforts as a nuisance, or worse, as competition, which on the eve of the biggest and potentially most risky application launch in the history of the company, sure does seem odd, doesn't it? But by all means, if you like what we've done, feel free to share it with anyone who needs it. I can explain more tonight. Please try and join us at 5. There's a bunch of people who are dying to meet you," he says. "And good luck with the build." Maxine opens up a terminal window on her laptop and starts following the instructions Kurt gave her. Her excitement grows when she realizes that this might be an actual working dev environment. She's exuberant when she's able to log in and type "make" on a command line, which starts streaming screenfuls of happy output onto her screen. She's delighted as she sees files getting compiled, binaries getting linked, programs being copied, build tools being installed and run. The output keeps going and going and going. Amazingly, Things are still building for 10 more minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes. She's relieved as it keeps going without an error, but starts to become alarmed at the size of the Phoenix build. It's huge. 45 minutes later, she can't hold off going to the bathroom any longer. She was too afraid she was going to miss something if she stepped away. She hurries there and back and is relieved to see that the build hasn't failed, still generating endless output in her terminal window. She scrolls through the history to see if she missed anything interesting. She decides to skip the next release team meeting just so she can watch the continuing build, which seems a bit irresponsible, but she knows that having a great build process is key to having a good code deployment and release process. And maybe with the help of these mysterious benefactors, she's on the verge of finally conquering the Phoenix build. The build output is hypnotic and educational because she's seeing some components of Phoenix for the first time. There's Java jar files, .NET binaries, Python and Ruby scripts, and lots of Bash scripts. Wait, is that a remote shell and installer that popped up? Before she can figure out what it is, the window is gone. Maxine's awe and concern at the size and variety of Phoenix continues to grow. She's about to scroll back further when she sees Eclipse being downloaded from somewhere. What in the world? She thinks. 20 minutes later, she could have sworn that she saw an Install Shield installer, but she knows she's getting tired and might be imagining things. Honestly, after another hour of watching build output, she's having trouble staying focused on the screen. But she can definitely see the different personalities and tech stacks of the different teams working on Phoenix. She had no idea there were so many. This is crazy, she thinks. There can't be this many teams working on Phoenix, right? And she wonders how any one person could possibly understand the system as a whole, especially when it's built from so many different technology stacks. Maxine isn't usually a fan of rigid standardization, but she's not a fan of everyone getting to choose whatever they fancy in the moment. Each decision is a commitment to support it for years or even decades. These are decisions that go far beyond just one team. Like most developers, she's very superstitious that if she stops watching the build, it will fail. Finally, nearly 3 hours after she started the build, she sees the scrolling output from her build window stop. Her heart falls when she reads, Builder, error, missing file, credentials.yaml. Damn! She's guessing that she needs a login credential that she doesn't have. She texts Kurt, and he quickly replies, Ah, yes, for that you need to open a ticket to get your login tied to your Active Directory account. Only Susan can issue those. Contact info coming. Instead of emailing Susan, Maxine goes to Susan's desk and learns that this missing file contains a cryptographic certificate that comes from some distant security group. Susan searches through years of emails to find out how to get a new one. When she finds it, Maxine takes a picture of the email address with her phone. She is so close to getting a Phoenix build going. Chapter 5, Thursday, September 11th. Still on a high after getting so far on the Phoenix build, Maxine hops in her car to make the 5-minute drive to the dockside parking lot, right on time for Kurt's mysterious meeting. She suspects that the shiny new Lexus IS300 in the parking lot is Kurt's. She doubts it's the Datsun 300 she parked next to. It's surprising that the meeting is at dockside. It's not one of the usual hangouts for technology people, but she knows it's a longtime favorite for many of the factory workers. Maxine asked some people about Kurt that afternoon. 3 people gave her enthusiastic endorsements, describing how competent and helpful he was. One development manager in her old group called him one of the smartest people in the entire technology organization. Curiously, one of her colleagues texted her, Kurt, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, which is why he's stuck in QA. He's also really nosy. Why do you ask? This made Maxine even more curious. What exactly is Kurt up to? His gift of the binder probably saved her months of waiting. But what is his motivation? He clearly has an inside track on getting things people need. She's pretty sure he isn't pilfering corporate resources, and even if he was, why would he give them to her? As she walks in the door, she's immediately hit by the smell of hops. She hasn't been here in years. She's relieved to see that it's much cleaner and brighter than she remembers. There's no longer sawdust on the floor, and it's more spacious than it seems from the outside. The bar is half full, but it's loud, maybe because of the cleanly swept cement floor. Seeing her, Kurt smiles and waves her over to a group of tables on the far side of the room, by some booths. "Hey, everyone, meet Maxine, the newest member of the Rebellion, if I can help it. She's the person that I've been telling you all about." She immediately recognizes the cranky developer who backed her up in the Phoenix status meeting about environments and is startled to see the petite woman named Shannon, who was with John earlier today. There's another man in his late 30s sitting next to someone who looks out of place. He's in his 50s and wearing a bowling shirt. Next to him is Brent, who she also saw in the Phoenix release meeting. He and Shannon are the youngest people at the table. Everyone has an open laptop in front of them. Suddenly, she wishes she had hers with her. She'd gotten out of the habit of carrying it around lately because she's had so little to work on. "You remember Dave?" says Kurt, gesturing at the cranky developer. "He's one of the dev team leads. He complains a lot, but he's probably banging the drum loudest on the need to pay down technical debt and modernize our architecture platforms and practices." Kurt laughs. "The reason Dave is so good is that he never asks for permission." Cranky Dave raises his glass at Maxine with the smallest of smiles, as if smiling causes him physical pain, then takes a sip of his beer. Up close, he looks older than her. "Breaking the rules is the only way anyone can get anything done around here," he grumbles. "Can't do anything without 20 meetings. Cranky Dave pauses. "You know, that's the best compliment Kurt has ever given me. You've probably noticed that he's running his own black market inside the company, right?" Kurt laughs, clearly not bothered by the characterization. "I'm just trying to solve people's problems. If I'm guilty of anything, it's that I care too much about the success of Phoenix, and even the whole company, to allow bureaucracy to kill it. And if that's a crime, I plead guilty. It's a pity no one will ever give us a medal for the great work we do." The satisfaction of helping people must be reward enough, right? Everyone groans, and someone from across the table hollers out, "Good one, Kurt." Ignoring the banter, Kurt points to the man in his late 30s who is wearing a funny vendor t-shirt. "This is Adam, one of my test engineers. But don't let his title fool you. He's a developer at heart, and he's also one of the best infrastructure people I've ever met. You can thank him for all those virtual machines and pre-built containers you got. He built them all. And that's only a fraction of what Adam does. His day job is helping automate a big chunk of the legacy test suite that we inherited from an outsourcer." Adam smiles sheepishly. "Actually, Brent over there did most of the work," he says. "He's an ace at infrastructure. We've been working together to try to automate environment creation for over a year. It's been a tough road, working evenings and weekends because it's not officially sanctioned. Despite all the dead ends and cul-de-sacs, we're proud of what we've been able to achieve. Your build notes were awesome, Maxine. Brent here almost fell over and died when he was reading through them. He'd been trying to piece that together for months," Adam says. Brent smiles at Maxine. "That was amazing detective work, Maxine. Documenting all those environment variables was so helpful." "Let us know how the environment works for you," Adam continues. "It's such a pain to get things from operations through normal channels, so we scraped together enough hardware to build a cluster big enough to support a couple of teams. Now you can get an environment on demand without needing to open up a ticket." Maxine blurts out, "Wow, thank you so much. The environment worked. I got 3 hours into the Phoenix build with it until it failed because of a missing certificate." "Wow, that's amazing," Brent says. "So where did all that hardware come from, if not from operations?" Maxine asks. Adam smirks. "Kurt has his ways. A little from here, a little from there, you know. Kurt keeps saying that it's best not to ask where it comes from. I've always suspected there are a bunch of people missing entire server clusters if they'd bother to check." Kurt feigns a hurt expression. "Server hoarding is a huge problem," he says. "Because it takes so long for ops to get anything to us, people always ask for way more than they need. And that makes ops' job harder and lengthens the lead times for everyone else, making the shortages even worse. It's like being in the old Soviet Union, where you have to wait in line for everything. You could say we're creating a secondary market to ensure that some of those unused environments go where they're needed most. You know, to ameliorate the mismatch between supply and demand, he says. Cranky Dave mutters, "Don't get him started," rolling his eyes as Kurt lectures like a professor. Adam adds, "But Dave is right. Kurt is running a black market." "Pay no attention to them, Maxine," Kurt continues. Next down the table, we have Shannon, a security engineer who works on building automated security tools. She spent nearly 5 years in the data warehouse team before that. She's currently working with Brent, experimenting with some machine learning and data visualization toolkits, and standing up some big data infrastructure, trying to get ahead of some of the marketing initiatives that we know are coming. You probably remember her from the full-scale red team exercises that she ran last year. Maxine smiles. That's why she looked so familiar. She definitely remembers. It was the first time she had been the target of a no-holds-barred penetration test. They had tried to plant malware by getting physical access to the manufacturing facilities, sending emails with malicious links, pretending to be company executives, and in one case, one of their most critical vendors. She had been very impressed. It takes a lot of balls to run those types of exercises, she thinks. Maxine remembers one person being fired for trying to do one because he made a bunch of people look bad. Shannon looks up from her laptop and says, "Nice meeting you, Maxine. I remember your group. You were one of the best prepared in the whole company. I was very impressed that everyone in your division knew not to click on links in emails, no matter how official they looked. Someone did a great job training everyone." Maxine nods with respect, saying, "Nice meeting you, Shannon. We spent weeks fixing the problems you all found. Nice work." Shannon looks back down at her laptop and types something. Suddenly, she looks up at everyone and says, "Oh, by the way, sorry about that episode with John. He's such a tool, but he's my boss." Everyone laughs, and several people imitate Shannon's expression from earlier today. Up next is the aforementioned Brent, who has his hands in everything infrastructure related. Kurt continues, "If it connects to AC power, Brent has probably mastered it. Networks, storage, compute, databases. But he's not just good with a screwdriver. He's always on the frontier of automation. Unfortunately, he's so good at what he does, everyone seems to have him on speed dial. And he's on pager duty way too often, which we're trying to fix." Brent merely shrugs his shoulders. Suddenly, the camera flash on his phone flickers, and notifications flood his screen. He picks up his phone and mutters, "Damn it, another outage call. I probably need to jump on this." He drains the rest of his beer and starts dialing his phone. "Yeah, that's a real problem," says Kurt, watching Brent walk away. "We've got to bring some sanity to his work life. He's brilliant, but because of the way people dump things on him, he hasn't been able to go on vacation without a pager for years." He pauses. "In the meantime, last but not least, is Dwayne," says Kurt, gesturing to the oldest person at the table. He's not only dressed differently than everyone, his laptop is different too. It's a beast, with a massive screen. He's a senior database and storage engineer from Ops, and was the person who brought Brent into this group. They conspire all the time to find better ways to manage infrastructure. Maxine smiles. To most people on the Phoenix Project, centralized ops are merely the people on the other side of a ticket. They're the people everyone is always complaining about. But clearly, Kurt and this motley crew have a different way of working, bypassing the normal organizational lines of communication, however informal. Dwayne reaches across the table, extending his hand. "Great to meet you, Maxine." Maxine realizes that Dwayne is wearing an actual bowling shirt, complete with his initials sewn on it, DM, and a faded mustard stain right next to them. "Dwayne has been trying to get automation initiatives going for years, but he and Brent always get shot down," Kurt continues. "So they've been helping Adam build up our own infrastructure instead. He knows almost everyone in operations, and he can usually get them to do anything. Like earlier this week, when we needed a firewall port opened between two internal networks, Dwayne made that happen." "All in a day's work," Dwayne says with a friendly smile. "But to be fair, Kurt is really the master of getting the impossible done. I'm just learning from him." Maxine is certain Dwayne is exaggerating. Dwayne looks like he's in his mid-50s.
Just how much could he learn from a young guy like Kurt?
Kurt leans back in his chair, arms spread out. Maxine, your work cracking the code of the Phoenix builds has impressed us all. We are in awe of the technical and social skills you displayed to successfully hunt down almost all the pieces of the environment, which required incredible perseverance, focus, and never taking no for an answer. Confused, Maxine looks around, but she sees everyone nodding at her, genuinely impressed at her work. Kurt continues.
We invite you to be a part of the inner circle of the Rebellion. We're recruiting the best and brightest engineers in the organization, training and preparing in secret for the right time to overthrow the Empire, the ancient, powerful, and unjust order that definitely needs to be toppled.
Everyone chuckles, and Cranky Dave raises his glass, shouting with a laugh.
To the overthrow of the Empire.
Confused, Maxine looks around the table. These are people from Dev, QA, Security, and Ops, a very unlikely group of people to be socializing, let alone working together. And she notices that everyone has a small sticker of the Rebel Alliance from Star Wars on their laptop, just like the X-Wing pilots wore on their helmets. She grins at their subtle but subversive badges of solidarity. Seeing Maxine toast with an empty hand, Kurt jumps up.
What do you want to drink?
A Pinot Noir, please. Kurt nods and heads toward the bar. But before he can take three steps, a tall and somewhat overweight man with graying hair walks up to him and gives him a big hug. In a loud and boisterous voice, he says,
Kurt, good seeing you again, my young friend. What do you need?
Noting the attention that Kurt's group gets from the bar staff, Maxine guesses they must come here often. She smiles. For the first time since her move to the Phoenix Project, she feels like she's in the company of kindred spirits.
Who are you people? Why are you all here? What are you possibly trying to achieve?
She asks quickly while Kurt is at the bar. Everyone laughs. Dwayne says,
As you know, we're a huge kumquat database shop, which is what I cut my teeth on. I want to migrate us to MySQL and open source databases wherever we can, because I'm tired of sending millions of dollars each year to an abusive vendor. We're figuring out how to engineer our way there.
Looking around, he says to everyone, Other companies have done this already. I think that anyone who is still paying kumquat database maintenance fees is simply too dumb to migrate off it. Maxine nods in approval.
Smart thinking. We've saved millions of dollars in my old group doing this, which we can now spend on innovation and other things the business needs. And it's been fun.
But why this crusade for open source software?
I'll tell you why,
Adam says. For almost 5 years, back when I was in operations, I had a team that kept getting pager alerts at 2 in the morning for some middleware we used. In almost every case, it was because of their database driver. I was the guy who had to generate a binary driver patch. After all that work, the problems started happening again 6 months later because when the vendor released their patches, they didn't integrate my fixes into their code. Next thing you know, we're all up at 2 a.m. doing the same thing over again.
Maxine is impressed. Adam has great kung fu, too.
And so does everyone else here. Cranky Dave frowns.
I've been at Parts Unlimited for almost 5 years, and I can't believe how the bureaucracy and silos have taken over. You can't do anything without first convincing a bunch of steering committees and architects or having to fill out a bunch of forms or work with 3 or 4 different teams who each have their own priorities. Everything is by committee. No one can make decisions, and implementing even the smallest thing seems to require consensus from everyone. Almost everything I need to do, I have to go up 2 levels, over 2 levels, and down 2 levels just to talk with a fellow engineer.
The square! Cries out Adam, and everyone laughs.
Dwayne chimes in.
In ops, we often have to do the return path. Up, over, down, and then back up, over, and down, before 2 engineers can finally work together to get something done. I want to bring back the days when a developer could actually create value for someone who cares, easily and quickly, Cranky Dave says. I want to build and maintain something for the long haul, instead of shipping the feature of the day and dragging all this technical debt around.
Cranky Dave is on a roll.
This company is run by a bunch of executives with no clue about technology, and project managers who want us to follow a bunch of arcane processes. I'll scream at the next one who wants me to write a product requirements document. The PRD, everyone shouts, laughing. Maxine raises her eyebrows. Those made sense decades ago, when you wanted written justification before you wasted a bunch of developers' time. But now, you can prototype most features in the time it takes to even write one page of a PRD. One team can now build things that used to require hundreds of people. Kurt sits next to Maxine, putting a glass of red wine in front of her. We're like the red shirts in Star Trek who actually get the real work done.
I was literally thinking that earlier, Maxine says, smiling.
Right? You've seen firsthand the reality bubble the bridge crew is in, Kurt says. They know the Phoenix Project is important, and yet they couldn't have come up with a worse way to organize everyone to achieve it. They outsourced IT, brought it back in, outsourced one piece, maybe two pieces, shuffled them around. In many areas, we're organized as if we're still outsourced, and nothing can get done without permission from three or four levels of management.
Kurt's right, says Cranky Dave. We're just another cost center. Little cogs in a big machine that can be easily outsourced to some random corner of the globe. We're viewed as replaceable and fungible.
That's why I'm here, Maxine, Shannon says. We could build a world-class technology organization and create an engineering culture. That's how we survive and innovate for our customers. And my dream is that everyone is the custodian of company data. It's not just the job of one department. In Steve's town hall, he talked about how we're being disrupted and how we need to compete with the e-commerce giants, she says. Well, we can only win by innovating and understanding our customers, which we can only do by mastering data. I think the capabilities we're building are the future of the company. Everyone cheers and hoists their glasses. After everyone is done toasting each other, Dwayne turns to Kurt and asks, "So how did the meeting go with your boss? You said you pitched William on funding an automated testing pilot." Everyone leans in. "You know, I really thought he was going to go for it. I had testimonials from two of the dev managers and a product owner about how great it would be. One of them had this great line, 'Without automated testing, the more code we write, the more money it takes for us to test.' Huh, I really thought that would scare the pants off of William." Maxine can feel the mood deflate around the table.
"Don't keep us in suspense, Kurt. What did he say?" prompts Dwayne.
"Son, let me explain something to you," Kurt says in a shockingly good impersonation of William. "You're young. You clearly don't understand how this game works. We're QA. We protect the organization from developers. It sounds to me like you've been hanging around too many of them. Do not trust them. Do not get chummy with them. You give developers an inch, and they'll take a mile."
Maxine laughs at Kurt's uncanny impression.
"Son, you're a pretty good QA manager with a $500,000 budget."
Kurt's on a roll.
"If you do your job well, you can be like me, with a $3 million budget. And if I do my job well, then I'll get promoted and have a $20 million budget. You go around automating your QA, your budget shrinks instead of grows. I'm not saying you're stupid, son, but you sure don't seem to understand how this game works."
Maxine laughs with everyone else. She is sure Kurt is exaggerating.
"William is like a union leader, not a business leader," Shannon says. "He only cares about growing his union membership dues, not about what's right for the business."
"You see the same thing inside ops and even InfoSec." A frown crosses Dwayne's genial face.
"Trust me, it's way, way worse in ops. At least development is seen as a profit center. In ops, we're a cost center. The only way to fund infrastructure is through new projects. If you don't find new funding sources, you're screwed. And if you don't spend your whole budget, they'll take the money away from you next year."
"Ah, the project funding model. Another big problem here at Parts Unlimited," Kurt says, as everyone groans in agreement.
"So what's your plan now, Kurt?" Dwayne asks.
"Don't worry, Dwayne. I've got another plan," Kurt says confidently. "We're going to lie low and keep doing what we're doing, looking for new potential customers and recruits. We keep our eyes and ears open for opportunities to get in the game."
"Oh, that's a great plan, Kurt,"
Dwayne says, rolling his eyes. We hang out at a bar, complain, and drink beer. Brilliant.
Dwayne leans over to Maxine, explaining, It's actually not that crazy. It's like in that movie Brazil, where the number one fugitive is the rogue air conditioner repairman who fixes people's air conditioners because central services never gets around to it. That's us. We're always on the lookout for places we can help. It's a great way to make friends and find potential new recruits for the rebellion.
What?
She says in disbelief. That can't work, can it? Well, it's how we got you here, isn't it? Dwayne says with a big smile. I'm working all the angles, Kurt continues. I'm even thinking about asking William if I can have a meeting with him and his boss, Chris. I'd tell William that it's really important to me that Chris hears my proposal and that I want him there.
Wow, Maxine thinks. That's pretty gutsy, maybe savvy, and probably fatal.
I'll keep you posted, Kurt says.
Okay, who has new information or intelligence to share?
Shannon updates everyone on a nascent data analytics group in marketing she's been working with, and how she's setting up a meeting between them and Kurt. They're working on a bunch of projects to increase customer promotion conversion rates, and boy, they really need help. They're not even using version control. They're struggling with basic data engineering problems, and they're still trying to get what they need from the data warehouse people, she says, visibly bothered by their suffering.
Kurt quickly pulls out an org chart on his laptop.
He asks her, another data analytics project? Who's funding it? How much budget do they have? Who's leading it? As she talks, he takes notes.
When it's his turn, Dwayne says, I've got bad news. The Phoenix release caught everyone in ops flat-footed. No one had it on their radar until last week. No budget was assigned to support it. Everyone's scrambling to find enough compute and storage infrastructure. This is the biggest launch we've done in almost 20 years, and everything we need, we don't have enough of. It's bad.
Holy shit, says Adam.
Yep,
Dwayne says.
I've been trying to tell everyone for months, but no one cared. Well, now they do, and everyone's dropping everything to support the Phoenix launch. Today, I heard someone trying to work with procurement so they can break the rules and order outside of the annual ordering process.
Despite the crisis, bean counters,